This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the new film Into the Woods, Meryl Streep plays the Wicked Witch.
By midnight tomorrow, bring me the items, or that child you wish for will never see the light of day!
Streep has just received a record-breaking 29th Golden Globe nomination for her role in the screen adaptation of the Stephen Sondheim musical. She already has won 8 Golden Globes. Terry spoke to Meryl Streep in 2012, the year she won an Oscar for her portrayal of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in the movie The Iron Lady. Streep is famous, among other things, for her uncanny ability to do accents. For The Iron Lady, she had to capture how Thatcher's voice evolved over the course of her political career. At the age of 49, Thatcher became the first woman to lead the Conservative Party. In this scene, she's speaking before the House of Commons as the men in the room try to shout her down.
Teachers cannot teach when there is no heating, no lighting in their classrooms. And I ask the Right Honourable Gentleman, whose fault is that?
Methinks the Right Honourable Lady doth screech too much!
Thatcher later took voice lessons from a drama coach to help her sound more authoritative. Here's Streep as Thatcher after those lessons, addressing Parliament about the war in the Falklands.
We were faced with an act of unprovoked aggression, and we responded, as we have responded in times past, with unity, strength, and courage. Sure in the knowledge that though much is sacrificed, in the end, right will prevail over wrong.
Meryl Streep, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry. I'm a huge fan.
Oh, wow. Thank you. So we just heard you before and after Margaret Thatcher has voice lessons to teach her authority and power so that she can speak more powerfully to the Parliament. How did you change your voice for the before and after, for the more confident and experienced Margaret Thatcher versus the early Margaret Thatcher?
Well, I had evidence of both voices, you know, from the public record, so I could listen to them. And it's sort of my fun to sing along with records and imitate people that are on the telephone that have different ways of speaking. I mean, I pick things up like that. So it's not a thing that's a struggle. It's work, but it's not a struggle. It's fun. And she had a very particular way of emphasizing points and making her point. And that had to do with bringing out a word that you didn't normally think was the most important word in the sentence. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And she also had a sort of a way, like a railroad train, of going, taking a breath and starting quite quietly and making a point in a way that you don't really know that this point is going to be made through several examples, and there will not be a break in the speaking voice at any point. And you, if you think you're going to interrupt, you're really not going to have the opportunity, because she's just got capacity. It's just really stunning as I looked at interviews.
So you need a lot of breath to keep talking like that. Did you have it?
I've just been talking like that. I did need a lot of breath. I needed much more breath than I have after all my expensive drama school training. I couldn't keep up with her.
I think it's interesting that when you're doing the voice of a real person, or I suppose if you're learning an accent too, you think of it as singing along with a record. So is that what you do, like you play Margaret Thatcher giving a speech and you do the equivalent of singing along with it? You give the speech as you're listening to it.
I say that because that's my way in, mm-hmm. in the very beginning, how to enter it. Very quickly in the process, I don't think about voice being separate from the way you hold your head or the way you sit or the way you dress or the way you put on lipstick. It's all a piece of a person, and it's all driven by conviction. In other characters, it's driven by insecurity, or it's driven by fear, or there's always a driver, and all the physical manifestations, you need your way in. So, yeah. When I was a kid, when I was 16, 17, I'd come home from high school, and my dad collected all of Barbara Streisand's records, and she was very young then. I think she probably had 3 records out, and she was 21. And we had them all. And I knew every single song, every breath, every elision, every swell, and I sang along to it. But it, for me, it was a way to get out the feeling of the song and also to get out the feelings that, you know, royal in high school, to express something that I had no other way of expressing. And, of course, now I'm rich and famous, and I met Barbara Streisand, and I told her that she was nonplussed. She was just... We can't know what we mean to each other. You know, artists, you can't know that. But she was really important.
You know, I hear a certain similarity between your voice in The Iron Lady as Margaret Thatcher and your voice in Julie and Julia as Julia Child. It almost strikes me as if, and I never thought about this till hearing you in both those films, that if Margaret Thatcher kind of drank too much and started being like surprised and delighted about how her like food concoction was behaving, that she might sound like Julia Child. What do you think?
Well, they had a similar flutiness in, especially in the younger Julia Child had a flutiness.
Yeah, you know,
which is and it's also part of her class, her the way that there are women of that time and of that class. We don't like to talk about that in America, but there are classes in America. And she was of a class of women who were wealthy, privately educated, went to Smith, moved in that sort of circle. She was conscripted into the OSS, which is the early CIA, which was all filled with Yaleys and Princeton and Harvard people, and a few women who were typing mostly, but also had something to do. And they had a way of speaking. I mean, the last person you would know, we would also recognize as having that way of speaking is Katharine Hepburn, probably. When I was at Vassar, and I came from a public high school in New Jersey, there was... that class still existed. I think it's pretty much gone. But there was a way of talking that the private school girls had that was different than the way I talked from New Jersey.
Let me play a little bit of you as Julia Child in Julie and Julia. And this is a scene when you're on TV, early in your TV career, and you're making some kind of like mashed potato pancake concoction that you're about to flip. And it doesn't go well. It kind of splatters in the air and half of it lands on the stove instead of in the pan. So let's hear a little bit of that. And this scene alternates with you on TV and with Julie watching you on TV.
Amy Adams, yeah.
Yeah, Amy Adams is Julie.
I'm going to try to flip this thing over now, which is a rather daring thing to do.
She changed everything. Before her, it was frozen food and can openers and marshmallows.
Don't knock marshmallows.
Give it a try. When you flip anything, you've just got to have the courage of your convictions, especially if it's a loose sort of mass, like, oh, that didn't go very well. But you see, when I flipped it, I didn't have the
She's
courage
so adorable.
I needed to the way I should have. Oh, but you can always put it together. And you're alone in the kitchen. Who's to see?
But pearls. The woman is wearing pearls in the kitchen.
Just got to practice. Like the piano. I'm Julia Child. Bon appetit.
You know, I love that because you talk about studying someone's voice as if it's music. And she has such a musical voice.
And she does. And she has no breath.
Yeah,
absolutely
none. That, exactly. It sounds like she's been running up a hill.
I mean, she always sounds like that. I feel like that when I'm in the kitchen, don't you? Well, I'm not a very good cook.
Me neither, honestly. I believe that's
why
delis exist, so that I don't have to cook. But,
well, I got better after this, and my entire family really did appreciate it. Usually they're resentful of movies that I go off and make, but this one had a bonus attached. But yeah.
You know, I compared her voice and Thatcher's voice before, but breath-wise, they're the opposite, because she's almost like gasping for air, and Thatcher has this like endlessly long breath.
Well, she's so alive, Julia Child, and Margaret is so designed. She's so intent upon making her point. That's the most important thing, is that she win the argument. And there is nothing that stands in the way of that train, you know. But Julia's just alive in front of you. That's part of why people loved her. They lived it with her. They breathed it with her. And the mistakes were all part of it. But she was adept, too, at what she was doing. Incredibly adept.
Meryl Streep speaking with Terry Gross in 2012. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2012 interview with actress Meryl Streep. She just received a record-setting 29th Golden Globe nomination for her portrayal of the witch in Into the Woods, the film version of the Stephen Sondheim musical. It opens nationwide Christmas Day.
Okay, so here's a story I read, which I assume is true, but you can tell me if it actually happened, that for the 1976 Dino De Laurentiis remake of King Kong, you auditioned for Dino De Laurentiis and his son,
yes,
who were Italian.
Yes.
And Dino De Laurentiis said in Italian, what did he say?
Che brutta. Perché mi, I don't know. I can't speak Italian anymore because I'm so old and forgetful. But he said something like, but this is so ugly. Why do you bring me this?
This being you.
Yes, yeah. I'm sitting in front of him, opposite the desk. He's smiling. He looks impeccable. He has everything beautiful. And his son was very kind. His son said, because his son had seen me in something. And he said, no, you know, Dad, she's a wonderful actress. And because I'd studied a year of Italian at Vassar, I could understand what they were saying. And I said, you know, mi dispiace molto, I'm very sorry that I'm not as beautiful as I should be. But, you know, this is it. This is what you get, sort of. And I left. I mean, I was very upset, but I didn't show it. Yes, it's a true story.
So, a very interesting story, because you were being told early in your career, basically, that you're not beautiful, you're not qualified, your face is not qualified for this role. And you're also...
face and body, I believe.
And body. But then you're also making the decision to let them know that you understand what they said. They were intentionally speaking in Italian so that you wouldn't understand them.
Right.
But you did understand them. You let them know you understood them. And
because they did, they think actresses are stupid. That was the other thing. That, I mean, not they, because I don't think his son was that way. His son was my champion. I mean, he was the reason I was in the office. But the dad, he wasn't being mean to me. He was just speaking to his son in Italian. But he had no idea that I would understand, because they think Americans are stupid too. So,
did you worry that you were basically? I mean, you hadn't been in any movies yet. So, did you worry that word would spread about you that you spoke back to directors?
Ass?
Yeah, that you were a real pain and that you were that you were a problem. So, like, avoid her.
I am a pain in the ass. How can I hide it? I mean, that is the package, you know. And but I was not probably suited to that role either. I mean, that was the truth.
How much did you want it?
Not much.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I did want a break, but I didn't think I would be good in it, honestly. I didn't. It represented something that, I don't know, I wasn't drawn to. So I suppose it was easier to be obstreperous in the meeting because of that. It was an audition for Sophie's Choice and Helen Bakula had said something like that, I maybe would have swallowed it because I wanted it so badly.
You were engaged to the actor John Cazale, whom most people know as Fredo in Godfather 1 and 2 and in
Dog
Day Afternoon. Why am I blanking on the title? And he had a small part in The Deer Hunter. You were nominated for an Oscar for your part in The Deer Hunter. It was like one of your first films. Mm-hmm. And so you were engaged, and he died of bone cancer shortly after in 1978.
Yes, we were not engaged, but we were a couple. We lived together, and yes, for like 3 years.
Mm-hmm. So he probably died not knowing how famous his roles were going to be, how famous those movies were going to be.
I know. He had The Godfather movies were unbelievably popular. And, you know, they were just, popular isn't the word.
They've entered into iconic.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did early. I mean, early on, they had that importance, certainly in New York, where we lived. And, you know, we would walk along the street, and people would roll down the window and go, "Hey, Fredo!" You know, and we could never pay for a dinner. If we went to Little Italy, never, which was great. We went all the time. But he made 5 movies, and all 5 of them were nominated for Best Picture.
You know, in his 2 most famous roles in Dog Day Afternoon and The Godfather, he did not play somebody who was very bright, but he's supposed to be a brilliant actor. Was that disconnect hard for him? Being really smart and playing kind of dumb in his best-known roles?
Well, he could sort of do anything. We met when we were doing Measure for Measure, Shakespeare in Central Park. He was playing Angelo, the evil administrator of this town in place of the Duke who's gone away. And, he was had great capacity as an actor. And he taught me a lot about acting. The directors used to call him 20 questions because he would just ask questions all the time, talk about a pain in the ass. I mean, he was really... But I learned that, you know, you can't know enough. You can't know
about the character?
Yeah. And what... About the character, but also what the vision is, what the person wants, because it's such a collaborative enterprise, you know, making a movie. And the actors get all the credit, but it's filtered through the director's point of view, always. So you want to know what they want. You can read something on the page and it appears some, you know, what David Lynch says, the world is as we see it. So we read a script and it appeals to us, or it moves us, or it jangles us according to our own lights. But, you know, the director may have completely other feelings. And so you need to know. And John always would ask.
Meryl Streep speaking with Terry Gross in 2012. Her new film, Into the Woods, opens on Christmas Day and already has earned her a Golden Globe nomination. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2012 interview with actress Meryl Streep. Her new movie, a film adaptation of the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods, already has earned her a Golden Globe nomination. She stars as the witch, a role originated by Bernadette Peters on Broadway.
You gave a terrific commencement address at Barnard in 2010. And one of the things you talked about was that the hardest thing in the world is to persuade a straight male audience to identify with a woman character. It's easier for women because we were brought up identifying with male characters in literature. It's hard for straight boys to identify with Juliet or Wendy in Peter Pan, whereas girls identify with Romeo and with Peter Pan. What led you to that conclusion?
Well, it seems like true.
I'll accept that as evidence.
All right. Let me do that was I have never I mean, I watch movies, and I don't care who is the protagonist. I feel what that guy is feeling. You know, if it's Tom Cruise leaping over a building, I want to make it, you know? And I'm going to, yes, I made it. And, yeah, so I get that. And I've grown up, well, partly because there weren't great girls' literature, Nancy Drew maybe, but there weren't things. So there was Huck Finn and Spinnin' Marty. The boys' characters were interesting, and you lived through them when you're watching it. You know, you're not aware of it, but you're following the action of the film through the body of the protagonist. You know, you feel what he feels when he jumps, when he leaps, when he wins, when he loses. And I think I just took it for granted that we can all do that. But it became obvious to me that men don't live through the female characters.
Do you think that women have that kind of double consciousness and men, you think, like boys,
I think it's,
don't make
it has
that
to
leap?
Do with,
yeah.
Well, it has to do with very deep things, you know, because it might be that imagining yourself as a girl is a diminishment. But it is something that, when I made The Devil Wears Prada, it was the first time in my life, 30 years of making movies, that a man came up and said, I know how you felt. I know how you felt. I have a job like that.
It's the first time?
First time. And they say lots of things. I think this is what I was trying to say in that speech. It's a very hard point to make because I guess it's hard to wrap your head around it, but for men, the favorite character that I've ever played is Linda in The Deer Hunter. Without question, of the heterosexual men that I've spoken to over the years, that's usually, they say, you know, my favorite thing you've ever done was Linda or Sophie. And they were a particular kind of very feminine, recessive kind of personality. They fell in love with her, but they didn't feel the story through her body. And it took to The Devil Wears Prada to play someone tough who had to make hard decisions, who was running an organization, and sometimes that takes making tough decisions for a certain kind of man to empathize. That's the word, empathize. Feel the story through her. And that's the first time anybody has ever said that they felt that way.
That's really interesting. Yeah, what do women tell you their favorite role is?
Oh, they love everything.
Okay.
Okay? They really do. I mean, it's a range of stuff. But I don't know. I really think there's a difference between how men, critics, see things than how women tend to. And I don't want to make that, it's not a generality, and I don't want to say that, but I just feel, I know I do the same thing. There are certain things that I just am not that interested in, certain kinds of films. I just don't enter them. I just don't enter the world, you know.
So do you like seeing yourself on screen, or is that an uncomfortable experience?
I don't dislike it. I don't, you know, pop in the CD, the DVD.
Let's look at that again.
Yeah. But I do think when, you know, sometimes the scrolling through the TV and there's something on and I look at it and I think, oh, my God, I thought I was fat. What is my problem? You know, when I was younger, I spent way too much time thinking about that. So stupid.
Well, Meryl Streep, I really regret that we're out of time. It's been great to talk with you. Thank
you
so much for being on our show.
Thanks, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Meryl Streep speaking with Terry Gross in 2012. She's nominated for a Golden Globe for her role as the witch in the Disney adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, which opens widely on Christmas Day. Here's a scene from another film for which Streep was nominated for an Oscar, The Devil Wears Prada. Streep plays Miranda Priestley, the demanding editor of a popular fashion magazine. Miranda is choosing an outfit for a spread in the next edition and trying to decide between two belts that strike her as very different. As she's deliberating, Her new assistant, played by Anne Hathaway, is laughing to herself.
Something funny?
No, nothing's, it's just that both those belts look exactly the same to me. I'm still learning about this stuff and,
This stuff? Oh, okay, I see. You think this has nothing to do with you. You go to your closet and you select, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns, and then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think we need a jacket here.
Mm.
And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.